Welcome back to the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast. Come join us in the library. What we know as the hungry ghosts, those suffering spirits with swollen stomachs and slender necks living out punishments for failed generosity, is actually a comparatively recent invention. Before there were hungry ghosts, from the Chinese e gui, there were the pretas, from the Sanskrit for departed. This preta realm, described in Pali and Sanskrit texts starting in the last few centuries BCE, was a more capacious, diverse world of ghosts, where ancestors might be promoted through Brahminical rituals, or where demigods might live in celestial mansions. Images of corporeal ghosts with insatiable desires do begin to develop in this literature, but those desires took varied forms, as did the bodies themselves.
And that's really where the book actually starts, is tracing this transformation of the preta from like the departed to this suffering reincarnated ghost. And then part of my interest in the literary portrayal of these pretas, part of it came from my longstanding interest in embodied difference and the way that religions make sense of and create hierarchies and subvert hierarchies of bodily difference.
Today, at the turn of a new year, we are launching a new series. Alongside our regular sequence of scholarly dialogues, and after last month's inaugural travelogue, this episode marks the beginning of Book Notes, a lineup of conversations with authors of new books in Buddhist studies. Our guest author today is Adina McNichol, assistant professor of religious studies in the Buddhist traditions of South and Southeast Asia at Vanderbilt University. Adina received her PhD here at Stanford in 2019, and her dissertation formed the basis of the book we'll be discussing, Of Ancestors and Ghosts, How Preta Narratives Constructed Buddhist Cosmology and Shaped Buddhist Ethics, published with Oxford University Press in 2024. As you'll hear, Adina is also at work on a second monograph on Black Buddhism, and has published on this topic in Religion Compass, the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, and Religion and American Culture. With support from the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation Center at the University of Toronto, and in collaboration with Professor Anne Gleig of USC, she's put together an online resource on teaching race and racism in Buddhist studies, which you can find at teachingbuddhism.net. To hear about Adina's other ventures, including two joint projects with alumni of our own center, listen on to the end of the interview. For now, let's open up Of Ancestors and Ghosts. Thanks, Adina, so much for joining us. It's lovely to see you and have you talk to us on the podcast. So I wanted to get started by, noting that you are a graduate of the Stanford PhD program and talking a little bit about how Of Ancestors and Ghosts, the book that we're here to talk about today, came out of your dissertation work from a dissertation that was then titled Celestial Seductresses and Hungry Ghosts. And we'll talk about how elements of that title got broken up and changed and revised. But could you take us a little bit back to your Stanford years, how this project formed, what kinds of collaborations lay behind it?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here and reflecting back on how this all started. So I entered grad school always very interested in stories about religion that we tell and the stakes that those have in the world. And that's really continued. That's what a lot of my research and my teaching focuses on thinking about, like, how do we tell responsible histories? How do we think about the stakes behind kind of the colonial origin of the study of religion? And, you know, how do we work through all of these things? And so initially I was going to work on this from deities in early Buddhism. And then as I was doing my qualifying exams, I read a translation of the Petavattu that I translate as Tales of the Departed in my book. And when I was reading that, I encountered all of these depictions of pretas that are typically translated as like hungry ghosts, but were not fitting the characteristics of like what you would expect when you were reading a hungry ghost. And so at some point I was like, I think I could do a dissertation topic on this. And that's really where the book actually starts, is tracing this transformation of the preta from like the departed to this suffering reincarnated ghost. And then part of my interest in the literary portrayal of these pretas, part of it came from my longstanding interest in embodied difference and the way that religions make sense of and create hierarchies and subvert hierarchies of bodily difference. But also, like, as I was translating these stories, I found myself being like, wow, these are like really disgusting, because you're really paying attention to the language and the visual imagery. And that kind of drove my interest in the book about like the affective and aesthetic aims of this literature.
Yeah, great. So we've got different dimensions to talk about. We've got the aesthetic, we've got elements of the embodied, which gets us into caste and gender, and then we've got just sort of the baseline chronology or history of this praetus concept. So tell us about that a little bit in terms of what are the expectations you go into by nature of where the praetus end up culturally or end up in terms of their iconography and what you ended up discovering as you were going farther back in the literature.
Right. So if you're reading an introductory textbook on Buddhism, or even really any book on Buddhism, the word praetus is often just translated as hungry ghost. And this comes from the Chinese translation for the term. The word praetus itself actually just means like departed. So hungry ghosts, you know, these are individuals that occupy one of the negative realms of rebirth. They're typically portrayed as having these really like distended, bloated stomachs, and in literature, mouths that are as small as the eye of a needle, but in artwork, it's often like super tiny necks, and this is supposed to show that they are characterized by this like unending like hunger as a result of the stinginess that they've displayed in a prior life. But in the Pali text, as I said, like praetas don't really look like this all the time, so. For like the historical component of my project, I read these narratives really carefully to examine exactly what language is being used to describe a praeta without making assumptions about what exactly like what kind of being that is supposed to really be talking about. And then I tried to situate that within the wider historical context of what else is going on in this period in South Asia and also just like prior to. So what we find is that, you know, some of these praetas are nothing more than just somebody's dead relative, who you're supposed to give offerings to in order to, you know, to help them in the next life. Sometimes they are suffering, but then sometimes they look like deities, and to the point that the texts are actually like interchanging different names for like deities with the praetas. And once we get these, what I call semi-divine praetas, then we get into, you know, praetas with like sex lives who are enjoying like everything that you would expect out of heaven. Sometimes they have a twist. Sometimes they're just chilling in heaven. So yeah, I compared all these different collections of stories about praetas that were composed at different times, and I also pay attention to the difference between like the commentarial layer and then the original verse layer. In order to think about some of the historical progression and to think carefully about commentators as people who are actually framing these stories for us, and they are suggesting that we should read, you know, the texts in a certain way, or we should listen to them and hear and like envision beings in a certain way. So part one of the book really lingers in these different historical layers to think about the intentionality of portrayals of praetas.
Yeah, and it's great that, you know, to put that together a little bit with what you were saying before about ways in which maybe these texts are being framed a particular way for you to have a particular kind of experience, but you found that you were having a visceral experience of reading these stories in particular ways. And it sounds like the aesthetic experience can range, if we're talking about, you know, sufferers to demigods, from something like disgust to wonder, or maybe a range of different kinds of aesthetic experiences. So insofar as we have to construct an image for ourselves that is not only the image of the swollen body and the sort of distended snake-like neck, or the verbal image of the sort of eye of the needle, mouth. What kind of images could you conjure for us of the aesthetic experience of reading these stories? What are maybe some ways you could bring that to life?
Yeah, there's a lot. Sometimes, you know, they invoke like pity. You know, people often, out of pity and compassion, want to help and alleviate the circumstances of these praetas. Some of them, you know, the story is like kind of sad. Sometimes they're also amusing, and you know, we always have to be careful when thinking about emotions, particularly like humor, when we're talking about other cultures. So for this, I think about like aesthetic moods in drama treatises in South Asia, and like how do they talk about the aesthetic or yeah, the aesthetic of humor, I guess. And a lot of it is around incongruity. And so like things that are unexpected. So, we have these stories where like women, instead of, donating alms to a monk, they take the alms bowl to the side and then they defecate it inside that bowl, and then they cover it over with rice, and then they present it to the beggar. And I think that's kind of it's kind of supposed to be funny. Like it's you would not expect it's such like a big twist from what you're supposed to do as a good Buddhist. There's yeah some wonder when particularly after pretas are helped, if they're like if they go from like suffering to suddenly they look like a deity, and there's this moment where people encounter them in their new form and they're like, wow, like how did that happen to you? Sometimes they're shocking, sometimes they're disgusting.
So in terms of, congruity and incongruity, part of your argument in part one, or really the core of your argument in part one, is about the building of a karmic cosmos, right? Of sort of understanding what certain actions in one's life might manifest themselves as in another life, and specifically in embodied ways, both in terms of what you did with your body when you were alive, and then what will happen to your body or what your body will have to endure in the next life. So tell us a little bit about some of those correspondences or maybe incongruities, as the case may be. How do we discover how that cosmos gets built and conceptualized by way of this particular after realm?
Yeah, there's a few ways that this operates, and a lot of it does have to do with the preta's body specifically. So I trace kind of multiple things are happening historically. So on the one hand, we have the attempt to negotiate the identity of the preta itself, and it eventually kind of coalesces into what we now know as a hungry ghost. That is very much characterized like by its bodily appearance. On the other hand, I say that these are texts that are arguing for the Buddhist understanding of karma, and they're partly doing this by showing how karma works on the bodies of the pretas themselves. So the way that the system works is that you do particular deeds, and this really influences your embodied circumstances in your next life. And for pretas, a lot of the time, this is really like literal and visceral. So, there's individuals who, if they engage in slanderous speech or false speech, then they might be reborn as a preta who has like a really stinky mouth. That woman who defecates in that alms bowl, she is reborn as a preta whose like entire existence is really encompassed by feces, to the point that like she's described as even looking like that herself. So the bodies really provide this way, not just like for the humans to see how karma works, but also like the pretas themselves are sort of like experiencing it in their bodies.
So one combination of the literary and the narrative, the textual that you're looking at with the historical work that you're doing, that really struck me came right at the end of part one, where all through part one you've been giving us, this account of the Sanskrit story of Kotikarna, which I guess comes from about the second century CE, and you're showing us how this character, this individual, is kind of traveling through particular realms and meeting different kinds of pretas. But then you've been planting this along the way, but then you reveal to us the gambit of the argument of the structure of the book, which is actually this journey is not just a cosmological journey. It seems to be kind of a historical journey between the different ways that pretas might have meant different things at different times. Could you take us through some of those beats of how that story reveals a kind of history to us?
Yeah, so for those of you not familiar with the story of Kotikarna, which I obviously love because it occupies so much of the first part of the book, the story centers around Kotikarna, who's this caravan leader. He's born in wealthy circumstances. He decides he wants to kind of go make his own way in the world. And so he leads a caravan out into the wilderness, but the caravan accidentally leaves him behind. And so then he's just takes off, tries to find his way home, and he winds up stumbling upon a series of different like preta cities and then mansions with different pretas. So the first ones that he encounters are these pretas in these like iron cities that are very similar to what we would understand as a hungry ghost. Like they have never even heard of the concept of water, let alone had water. And he enters the city looking for water, and he gets swarmed by all these praetas. And he tries to get water from them. They're like, "We haven't even heard of water until you came here." And so he asks, like, "Who are you?" And they explain who they are. But what we would expect, in Buddhist studies is that they explain that they are praetas that are in the praeta realm. And that's not actually where they say they are. They say that they're in the realm of the ancestors, which is the Brahminical ancestral realm, that's this like heavenly realm. So this is the kind of historical origin for praetas. They start their history off in Brahminical ritual literature as this temporary state of existence between kind of like a deceased individual and then ancestor in heaven. So after you die, you become a like disembodied individual, and you need ritual help mediated by Brahmins in order to help you obtain this realm of the ancestors. So for the Brahmins, they would mediate what are known as Shraddha rites, where over time these Shraddha rites restore the body of the preta, culminating in their like digestive faculties. And at that point, the preta is able to move up to that status of ancestor. So this concept of preta, it's a pre-Buddhist one. And what's going on in the story of Kotikarna is like they are actually kind of playing on that a little bit intentionally, I think, because they could have very well said, like, "We are born in the Preta realm, and we are Pretas." Instead, they're like, "We are suffering ghosts, and we are in the Brahminical ancestral realm." So this really is, I think, an intentional move that's subverting what other people would have expected, also in terms of thinking about the ancestral realm, in order to claim that pretas actually are not, these just like any departed ancestor, but they're specifically beings who have been born due to their karma in a particular area of the cosmos. And then after, Kotikarna sees these pretas, he encounters the ones in celestial mansions. And it culminates in this final woman who uses her departed relatives, who are these like pretas, that are just like attached to the corners of her couch. And she uses the circumstance of these pretas to teach Kotikarna about how karma works, and specifically how it works in relation to the preta realm.
Oh, great. Yeah. So that's fascinating, because I was kind of tracking it as a chronological argument, but it sounds like that it's even more complex than that, where sometimes you're getting an overlay or a sort of, or as you say, like a twist or a shifted expectation between sort of two different ages or two different conceptualizations of the Preta realm, where you could have a Preta who seems to exist or seems to understand themselves as belonging to a pre-Buddhist Indian concept, and yet by nature of the kind of suffering they're going through, shows the sort of religious doctrinal update that has transpired in the centuries intervening. Is that right?
Yeah, and I mean, of course, like I give it this historical progression, but this is also happening at the same time. So it's not like, we have like the Brahminical realm of the ancestors, and then Buddhism emerges, and then like we just like forget about the Brahminical realm of the ancestors. Like the Brahmins themselves are still reconciling what happens to the realm of the ancestors now that we have this understanding of samsara and reincarnation. So all of a sudden, you're not being promoted to this permanent heaven. And these negotiations are all happening alongside each other and in conversation with one another. So it is historical in terms of like we can trace, over time, this coalescing of the Buddhist concept of a preta. And we can also trace like when this enters in back into Brahminical literature, but it's also happening at the same time.
Yeah, it's an intervention in an ongoing kind of dialogue between religions and between understandings, it sounds like. It's not a matter of a sort of story that's been settled and it's then being narrated retrospectively. That's great. So let's turn a little bit to part two, where you think a bit more about the aesthetics of these texts and the different embodied natures of the pretas, and getting you into your interest in particularly the kind of other the various forms of otherness that the pretas represent. So there's so many fascinating different details across the different chapters, and I, of course, encourage people to go read and discover these from the stories of disgust that you allude to before, where we have to think about, is disgust supposed to elicit revulsion or compassion? Then you have, the question of sort of where do the pretas land with regard to teaching? Are they, objects of study, of sort of like, let's learn from these mistakes, or are, by nature of them continuing to inhabit our world, are they capable of being teachers for us? But, I thought, among all of those, maybe the one that would be fun to focus on is this figure of the celestial seductress, because it was part of the two halves of your initial dissertation. It was a chapter within that dissertation, and now it's got to be framed in this sort of new expansive part two of the book. So tell us about how it fits into the book project when you've done that revision, and why it remains a kind of interesting case study for you.
Yeah, I think it's remained an interesting case study for everybody. Everybody loves that section of the book. So I guess for any grad students who are finishing their dissertation or anybody who's recently completed a dissertation and thinking about, how do you adapt it to a book? Basically, for context, I had a hard deadline set for my dissertation defense because I had accidentally gone and got myself a job. So I really needed to finish the dissertation. And so shortly before the deadline of when everything had to go in, I realized that the dissertation was structured incorrectly for the story that I wanted to tell. And I decided that it was defensible, so I just defended it. And I said, during the defense how I was going to update it, and this is basically the result. So really the book moved a lot. There's only, I'd say only the chapter on disgust is the one that really maintained its integrity. The rest of it got really like fully taken apart and used as evidence to tell the story that I wanted to tell. So even like the discussion of like celestial seductresses in the book, the chapter it's part of, it gets like scrambled across what becomes the actual book. So the discussion of celestial seductresses becomes part of a chapter focused particularly on gender in the book itself. And in the book, I update the discussion in a few ways. So I one way is to provide a larger discussion about norms of masculinity that we find in the stories, so that I pull that out a lot more. The greater one is probably more of like a methodological one, where I adopt more of a feminist hermeneutic based on work of Amy Langenberg to unearth not just the normative lens of these kinds of stories about gender, but also the various tensions that are going on between different gender norms across, Brahminical texts, the general patriarchal household or society, the ideals of a celibate sangha, and then the everyday realities of men and women who are just negotiating the world. So in the book, I try to unearth the ways that these stories can also lead to readings that push us into alternate directions and alternate kinds of visions of the future that sort of, they're acknowledges that they're within this androcentric framing, but they're constantly expanding beyond that. So I talk about these stories about humans who are reborn as semi-divine pretas, who then engage in cross-species sexual relationships inside the preta realm. So the men will actively pursue women, and they bring them back to their celestial mansions by like kidnapping them, or they pay a bride price for them. And both of these tactics are recognizable forms of marriage in Brahminical dharmic literature. And once there, the women engage in a sexual relationship with the preta. Meanwhile, for the stories about the female pretis, these celestial seductresses, they don't actually leave the realm. They instead lure their male partners to their like mansion, and then they have a relationship with them there. So there's a lot going on here in terms of, gender. The stories are, attempting to relegate the transgression of norms of gender and sexuality to the preta, like non-human realm. So they're the all of these stories are warning about the dangers that attachment to the female form and also agentive female sexuality can pose to men. So it's attachment to women that causes these semi-divine male pretas to be reborn in the preta realm. But the stories of the semi-divine female pretis, they align with these broader tropes in Indic literature about the sexual appetites of women and the dangers of women's intellect when they're used to lead men astray and then sometimes to their doom. But I consider in this chapter, again, as kind of this updated reading, whether the unregulated nature of this non-human realm actually helps provide an opening for alternate readings of female sexuality and provides the space to think of female sexuality as agentive, as vulnerable, and even in ways that reject the norms of sort of the socioeconomic marriage ties of Indic society at the time, because all of these women are engaging in sex for pleasure and not for any sort of like reproductive potential. And that's okay because they're doing it in the non-human realm.
Yeah, I was thinking, going back over these pages and thinking a little bit about, as you say, why people are drawn to this argument and to this particular set of tales. And one detail that really jumped out at me was, this quote that you bring up from the Sutra on the Application of Mindfulness of the True Dharma, where you say that it's being noted in the commentaries that women are frequently born among the hungry ghosts, and then the commentator thinks like, why is this? Women are more jealous by nature. There's sort of other assumptions about women, within which we have to reckon with sexuality. I guess I wonder, maybe about putting an analysis of these stories in that context. Is it in fact the case that women seem to be disproportionately represented in these stories, or represented in a particular way? Are the Preta stories preoccupied with gender in a way that you maybe wouldn't see in other kinds of stories that are trying to explain the cosmology? And what's your feminist hermeneutic approach to that problem as a whole?
Yeah, so the extent to which we see women kind of predominating the Preta realm really depends on the text collection. So in general, the Sanskrit texts seem to have more of this. And then even like looking at the Avadhanashataka, that Preta chapter, when you look at its translation into Chinese, they switch the gender of some of the individuals. So there's even more representation of women versus we don't see as much of that going on in the Pali literature, even though we do still have these like very gendered portrayals of men and women. So we have to be careful in terms of thinking about like what genre of text and what is the purpose of that genre of text. It might be that we have more men portrayed in Tales of the Departed because when we're looking at a lot of the stories that are just about departed individuals, we have to remember that the Brahminical realm of the ancestors was a male realm. So it possibly makes sense that we see more men in terms of like the Pretas in those stories, but then what those stories also do is they portray women making offerings to those pretas, which is typically not what women do. It's theoretically allowed in the Brahminical literature, but it's not supposed to be the norm. Like the firstborn son is supposed to do that. So, yeah, I think, I guess, like in terms of what to do about this, in terms of it, like the cosmological portrayal of some of these lower realms with women is, I try throughout to acknowledge this kind of framing and then see how much we can actually expose the particularness of it rather than it being, universal. And also think about like where can we push beyond it? And I look a lot to, other scholars and also practitioners who are adopting, feminist and queer lens, and what are they doing with similar stories as this one, and how are they trying to negotiate it, to see, what are the possibilities, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that leads me to sort of a final question, which is about where your research is going forward, where I think some of these interests in, not just gender, but race and caste and other forms of what might be the non-normative relative to the Brahminical or relative to sort of other gendered constructs, let's say, in the early Buddhist literature is salient to you. I'm thinking of the fact that, as I've gathered from your website and from talking to your colleagues, that you are working on a documentary reader on Black Buddhism with Ralph Craig, who is also on our podcast, and a Buddhism and Caste Initiative with Nicholas Witkowski, who we're in touch with as another alum of Stanford and our program. Could you tell us a little bit about those two projects and what it has you reading and what it has you thinking about?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my second monograph is going to be this longer history of Black engagements with Buddhism from the late 19th century up until the Cold War. But the Black Buddhism documentary reader with Ralph Craig, the third of his name, that's kind of extending on that project and then also bringing it to the contemporary period. So our goal is to create a resource of primary sources that is contextualized historically and also in relation to like how can we read and teach these sources. So we really want it to be something that'll be useful for the classroom for both Buddhist studies, but also scholars of American religion and African American religion, and how we can situate Black Buddhists responsibly within these different fields. And we also want it to be useful to practitioners themselves, in a sense of providing a history, providing a canon of source of teachers with whom they can, see like representation. So yeah, we're currently working on that. And then with Nicholas Witkowski, yeah, we're working on what we've called the Buddhism in Caste Initiative. And this helps me kind of bridge both of my fields in early Buddhism and then also thinking about Buddhism in the contemporary period. So we have started a 5-year seminar with the American Academy of Religion. This is our first year in 2025. And the idea is to create this community of scholars who are talking about Buddhism and caste in the past and the present, in South Asia, also outside of South Asia, and in relation to the intersections of gender, sexuality, class, race. And we're hoping that we'll be able to culminate in a handbook on Buddhism and caste.
Great. Okay. So a documentary reader, a handbook, and a monograph all in the near future. This is, nice for us insofar as we're constructing this episode around books and Buddhist studies that are really up to the moment. Is there anything else that you would recommend as reading in any of these topics that you've found yourself digging into recently?
So what I've been reading, one is Sarah Azaransky's book, This Worldwide Struggle, which looks at the international and interreligious origins of the civil rights movement, which is, yeah, I think really great for thinking about in terms of like the study of Black religion, the way that the civil rights movement, even though we associate it with Christianity, is really internationally informed. And I've been working on a chapter that brings Buddhism into that particular story. Also, Nico Slate's Colored Cosmopolitanism, which looks at the history of comparisons between race and caste and the ways that's developed over time, and like the ways that sometimes there's been misses on either side, but also how this comparison allows people to develop solidarities with each other.
Well, thanks so much. That's great to have that bibliography and that sort of live collaborative research work in our minds going forward. Well, we really appreciate having you on the show and kind of being back in touch with your Stanford roots. So really appreciate it, Adina, and we hope we'll be hearing more from you soon as some of these new projects either hit AAR or hit the book stands.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Adina McNichol for joining the show and talking about her work. You can get a copy of the book, Of Ancestors and Ghosts, from the Oxford University Press website at oup.com. Next month, the Book Notes series continues with an interview with Meir Shahar, author of Kings of Oxen and Horses, which just appeared with Columbia University Press in 2025. You can check out a preview of that conversation now on our YouTube channel, alongside a video recording of the interview you just heard. For now, here is a new selection from Ani Choyung Drolma's performance at Stanford in 2017. Thanks for listening. Hami sabai ko
Aruki.